Your Honor, we'd like to call as our next witness, Dr. Jack Stanford.
Okay.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Jack A. Stanford.
Where do you live?
I live as a resident in Twist, Washington now, but for almost 50 years, I lived at Flathead Lake Biological Station where I was the director.
Do you still have property in Montana?
Yes, I own a 300-acre property in the Mission Valley. It's fallowed and not farmed.
Dr. Stanford, have you been asked by plaintiffs to serve as an expert in this case on certain topics which are summarized on the slide?
Yes, I have.
And what are those topics?
Well, in the context of climate warming as identified by the IPCC, I want to talk about the impacts of climate change on Montana's freshwater ecosystems. And a key concept for this discussion is the idea about timing and volume of precipitation. And we'll talk about how climate system, put that in the context of potential declining, resources.
Dr. Stanford, before we take a deep dive into those matters, I'm going to ask if you could direct your attention to my next image here and just give us a kind of a broader overview. And I'll represent to you that this is an image from your expert report. And you have cited it as sourcing from the article published by the United States Environmental Protection Agency entitled Connectivity of Streams and Wetlands to Downstream Waters, a review and synthesis of the Scientific Evidence Technical Report EPA-60-R. First, could you explain to the court if that is a reputable publication recognized by professionals such as you as authoritative?
Very definitely. It was authored by about 50 of the world's leading aquatic scientists for the purpose of describing how water flows from the very headwaters all the way to the ocean. And some of the important concepts that were not covered very well in the Clean Water Act, particularly the flow paths of intermittent and isolated wetlands.
Have you found this publication useful in terms of your profession as a freshwater ecologist and especially in terms of communicating concepts related thereto?
Yes, I've used it in many different situations, and it's occurred or it's been reproduced in a number of very high-profile publications that all of us in the business of understanding the dynamics of freshwater ecosystems use routinely.
And Dr. Stanford, did you rely upon it and cite it throughout your expert report disclosed in this case?
I did.
Your Honor, we're going to move into evidence. Plaintiff's Exhibit P-82, which is the document that we've just been discussing.
Your Honor, I have no problem using it as a demonstrative, but it, regardless of whether he relied on it, it's still hearsay, and we object on those grounds.
Well, I don't think it is hearsay, but if it is, it certainly is qualifies as an exception to the hearsay rule number one. And number two, under both rules 702 and 703, it certainly is a document that he has used, that he has relied upon. And in particular, it's going to refresh his recollection. For all of those reasons, Your Honor, it is at your discretion to admit it, to kind of simplify and make a clean record here.
All right. P-82 is admitted.
Using the image there from that study, Dr. Stanford, as useful, before we take the deep dive, would you explain to us kind of the overview about this concept of the hydrologic connectivity in ecosystems?
Right, in freshwater ecosystems.
Freshwater ecosystems.
So the hydrologic cycle delivers water mostly to the high country in each river catchment in Montana and elsewhere. And this water collects and flows down through very important and identifiable flow paths to either where it's impounded in reservoirs or passes on by, used by agriculture, or passes on by and eventually goes to the ocean. So this idea of being connected from the very top to the very bottom with all the different components that occur along the way is fundamental to understanding the ecology of aquatic ecosystems. Rivers are the lifeblood of the country and lifeblood of any ecosystem. And they're rather like the veins in your body. They deliver things to other habitats and many different organisms, and people depend on the maintenance of the connectivity from headwaters to the ocean.
Thank you. What general time period does your analysis in this case cover in terms of your opinions and analysis of the freshwater ecosystem here in Montana?
Well, it certainly covers the breadth of my career, which is nearly 50 years long, and because I started off in my early work on organisms that live in rivers and how they conduct their life cycle and how they're important in understanding how materials and water are transported in river systems. So the time span for me personally would be that entire duration. But there were many ecologists that came before me that did significant work that helped underpin what I did, and that cascades all the way up to the present. So quite a long time.
Your rather extensive curriculum vitae has been marked as plaintiff's exhibit P-194 that we exchanged with defendants a while ago, and I would ask counsel at first if they have an objection to the admission of P-194, his curriculum vitae.
No objection.
P-194 is admitted.
Would it be possible, I see that's a multi-page document, Dr. Stanford, but could you briefly provide the court with a summary of your education, referring for the benefit of the court and us to the slide image on the screen?
Well, I did bachelor's and master's at Colorado State University, focused on the bachelor's on fishery science and the master's on limnology, which is the study of freshwater. I may use that term quite frequently, limnology, the study of freshwater. And then a PhD in river ecology at the University of Utah.
And what about in terms of just summarizing for the court the basics of your professional experience?
Well, that basis of my experience would be conducting basic research about how aquatic systems function and how human influences impact those functions. And then secondly, teaching that to undergraduates and particularly graduate students as time went by.
In terms of how and where you did that, could you just walk us through your location of your various professional positions there on the slide image?
Okay. And starting at the bottom there, I was hired as an assistant professor in the Department of Biology at University of North Texas after conducting my PhD work at the Flathead Lake Biological Station, focused on aquatic insects in the Flathead River system. And I was advanced to associate professor level at NTSU, all the while of those years conducting research and sending graduate students to the biological station to do their work for their degrees at that Texas institution. Started a little bit of Texas money there. And so then in 1980, I became director of the station, and the moved to Montana, and all of my work continued since then.
During the course of your decades there as director of the Flathead Lake Biological Station, did you work to transform its mission from more or less a simple educational mission to also a research mission?
Yes, that was the assignment that I got from the college dean when he hired me as director of the station in 1980. It was to build a world-class research program at the biological station that took advantage also of resources on the main campus in Missoula. And so I had the charge to move this interesting facility from a summer teaching facility to a research facility that also continued to teach or explain to people what we did at the station. I must emphasize that while I was teaching students enrolled at the University of Montana, we also did a tremendous amount of outreach to the communities in and around Flathead Lake and way beyond there to make them get, help them understand how complex and yet important our aquatic resources are in an ecosystem context.
Did you have a primary area of research?
My area was too wide, perhaps, but I did work on lakes, and I did work on rivers from very small streams that you could jump across to some of the biggest rivers in the world, at least in North America and the Russian Far East and South America. And so my research evolved from simultaneously doing work on Atlantic or lake and wetland habitats, and then really expanding the program and focusing on river systems in context of connectivity, which I'll probably refer to repeatedly. So important.
Dr. Stanford, have you authored any books or peer-reviewed articles on these topics?
Yeah, I've published either as author or co-author of 220 jury papers in my fields of limnology writ large, and also edited or produced about 12 books in the same time period. The books are important because they're sort of synthesis works, whereas the papers are, the professional papers are new findings about how water and the water organisms function, whereas the books are sort of synthesis of all of that information. And often I was joined by other authors from around the world on those books.
Dr. Stanford, has your work been recognized through awards honoring or recognizing your professional achievements?
I'm happy to say that it has. Some of the awards are listed here, but what's most important to me is the Award of Excellence by the Society of Freshwater Science and the Lifetime Achievement Award of the International Society for River Science. That really acknowledged the importance of the work that we've been doing all those years at the biological station and beyond.
And I think you mentioned just briefly earlier, you were awarded an endowed professorship during the time of a long portion of the time that you were a professor at the University of Montana.
Yes, when I became director of the biological station, I entered a full professorship. And then in 1986, I was awarded an endowed chair at the biological station.
Is this the first time that you've been asked to testify as an expert in your field?
No.
Could you summarize for the court other instances where you have appeared to offer testimony?
I've appeared many times in controversial issues regarding freshwater, from varying from local disputes to, say, dealing with controversial developments around Flathead Lake, that more local type of interaction, to federal legislation such as the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. I gave testimony to Congress on those, importance of those bills when they came up.
And that was at the invitation of the United States Committee on Environment and Public Works?
Yes, and also some of the senators in the on the committees.
Dr. Stanford, are you charging the plaintiffs in this case for your time serving as an expert witness?
No, I'm not.
Why?
I've worked my whole career to provide a basis for understanding how important water systems are and how complex they are, and to see that work essentially be changed or certainly altered by a climate warming that could be prevented, could be curtailed. I just feel like the rest of my life I'm going to have to use my credentials to talk about the importance of this issue.
Dr. Stanford, in your expert disclosure, you indicated that all of your opinions were based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Will you please answer my questions today to that same standard?
Yes.
Your Honor, at this time, I tender Dr. Stanford as an expert in the areas that he has outlined in this initial part of his testimony.
Yes, he's an expert.
Dr. Stanford, in terms of preparing for your testimony, I note that you indicated that you reviewed various studies that were then compiled as attachment two to your expert report, indicating that those were materials that you considered informing your opinions?
Yes.
And I would offer into evidence at this time what has been marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit 308, which is attachment two to his expert report listing the materials relied upon.
No objection.
P308 is admitted.
Dr. Stanford, turning now to this concept of the interconnectivity of the hydrologic cycle and freshwater ecosystems, could you explain to us in more detail now your opinions on how the adverse impacts of climate change affect Montana's freshwater ecosystems, starting wherever you deem appropriate?
Okay. Well, since I've already said that the important concept is understanding what happens to water as it drops on the high mountains and then flows in different flow paths down through the landscape of the watershed to the oceans or whatever confluence there is. And it all begins with the hydrologic cycle. This is fundamental stuff. The air masses that are moving largely in Montana from the Pacific Ocean across the intervening country to Montana is the source of much of the precipitation that we get. And it's precipitation that falls on the surface of the ground and infiltrates into the ground in many cases or runs off that provides the flow that we see in our river systems. So think of it this way, the water coming as a sort of a highway from the Pacific Ocean. Some of the news recently has characterized it as, what did they used to call that? Atmospheric river. Yes, you got it better than I do. Atmospheric rivers. That term really has emerged only in the last few years. What we're talking about, though, is water that's part of the atmosphere that moves into our state. And then as it begins to interact with the topography of the state, the water condenses and forms clouds and comes down onto the land surface. Of course, the amount of precipitation is higher in the mountains, because there's a orographic effect as that water-laden clouds hit the mountains and move up to where it's cooler and cooler and cooler, and eventually it either comes down as water or snow. So that's the precipitation that's shown in this diagram. And oh, by the way, in Montana, we're the water towers of the continent, because water can flow from Triple Divide Peak to the Saskatchewan River system going north to Hudson's Bay, or it could flood across Montana, flow across Montana via the Missouri River system, or come by from another flank of the mountain to the Columbia system. So the extreme importance of precipitation on our mountains influences almost every other person on the continent, because these rivers cover so much territory. Snowmelt runoff then hits the lower elevations and will either run off as surface runoff, and where this figure is wrong, it doesn't show the groundwater as an important flux pathway, but will fill up our streams and flow paths above and below ground to then provide a water source for all of the plants along the way and all of the agriculture along the way. The water returns to the atmosphere via via evaporation and via transpiration by the plants. Transpiration is the metabolic product of the plants growing, and it's an extremely important contributor to the atmosphere that can, along with warming temperatures, really cause the dehydration of the soils. So evaporation and transpiration are really important, and that's the products of plants growing and using up CO2 that's in the atmosphere as a part of production of biomass, which is done by primary producers or the plants that have chloroplasts that use CO2 to produce carbohydrates and oxygen. So that's the hydrologic cycle, and it's fundamental to understand that that's where it all begins, is in the way in which this interconnection between atmospheric waters and the landscape plays out.
So would it be fair to say, Dr. Stanford, that this water tower effect that you've described and then the runoff from it, does it then flow out across the Montana landscape?
It flows across the landscape and within the landscape. I have to, my research is really focused a lot on the exchange of surface waters and groundwater. So if you visualize a river starting the mountains and flowing to the ocean, part of the time that water is above ground and part of the time that water is underground, depending on the kind of stream corridor that the water is following. If it's a real rocky, sandy, porous substratum, then a lot of the water in the river channel will penetrate into the ground and flow through the ground above areas where the water is sealed off from getting further deeper into the ground. So water is flowing above and below ground.
Do these freshwater resource flowing across the Montana landscape affect the well-being of these youth plaintiffs?
Of well-being of what?
The youth plaintiffs.
Oh, of course. Yes. Not just them, but everyone. We can't get through life without a reliable source of fresh water. And that's not just water for drinking or irrigating. That's water for all of the components of the ecosystem that provide stability to the system that we are trying to preserve. So yes, it's very important to the plaintiffs and to me.
Is this Montana supply of fresh water threatened by anthropogenic climate change?
The sunshine in this figure, as it warms and warms and warms as a consequence of the greenhouse gases, that's going to dry out the soils. It's going to cause greater transpiration from the plants. So yes, there's a very deep concern amongst the scientific community about the direct effects of climate warming, of warming of landscapes. But there's also many, many indirect effects that are hard to predict that are beginning to play out now where we can measure them. And some of them are pretty surprising because we didn't include them as we described the hydrologic cycle and this multi-flow path descent of water from the mountains to the oceans.
As it makes its way through the landscape, how is the precipitation retained?
Well, it can be retained in small or even large wetlands. It's retained in aquifers that are associated with the river. We call them alluvial aquifers because the aquifers are water that's stored in large deposits of gravel and cobble that often occur along rivers, particularly in Montana, because we're so high in the watersheds. I forgot where I was going.
So just to be clear, also the water and in this hydrologic cycle that's occurring, that water includes then cycling through the atmosphere.
Sure, of course. And storage, again, thinking about storage of water as opposed to it moving in the river channel on by, we store it in wetlands associated with the river and in aquifers associated with the river. And then, of course, we store it in reservoirs and where we built dams and so on.
Dr. Stanford, is it fair to say that the waters in Montana's rivers lakes, aquifers, glaciers, snow, and plants are inextricably interconnected with atmospheric waters?
Yes, absolutely, and in complex ways.
And is that a fundamental component of the hydrologic cycle?
Fundamental.
Okay. Referring once again to this earlier image from the EPA document, Dr. Stanford, can you describe to us in just a little more detail the numerous flow paths that are sometimes referred to in terms of the water?
Yes, this is the best attempt of the 50 of us that got together to provide in one diagram what you would probably see in terms of the complexity of a flow path from the mountains to the ocean in any river system. So it was intended to apply broadly. Well, it applies very well to Montana because we have flows, obviously, that we know very well from the mountains creating streams. And streams come together to form larger streams. And as you get down towards the valley bottoms, away from the steep gradient of the mountains, that water is carrying not just water, that flow of water is not just carrying water itself, but also all kinds of materials like sediments, rocks, gravel. And those gravel deposits, cobble deposits, are deposited on the floodplains of the river further downstream. And that's what this shows, where the little plants are growing out of the wetlands associated with the river in the middle of the picture. And all of that, of course, is driven by the big green arrow that's the water coming off the landscape, flowing either above, and then the arrow is slightly diffused below. That's water moving through the ground. So it's moving above and below ground, and it's feeding all of these different habitat types along the river corridor. The wetlands near the river are the riparian zone, as it's sometimes called, and also feeding isolated wetlands that are only temporarily or intermittently connected to the flow path by the consequence of the topography of the basin or other circumstances. So the point is that the landscape of a river is extremely complex and involves many different habitat types depending on how the water gets there and when it gets there. But flooding and drying is a normal process in the river system unless you get out of the range of variation that has been in play to produce them to start with. Now, the brown arrows in this figure are important too, because that's regional groundwater moving from isolated deep aquifers or phreatic waters into the river bottoms and providing yet another source of water for flow in the river. So the groundwater brown arrows are also a flow path that's feeding this conceptual river system we have here. Notice the red arrows too, they're exchanging from the river channel and cobble and porous materials that are outlined in kind of white there. That's the alluvial accumulations that occur in almost all river systems. And there are all kinds of exchanges between those, it's called hyporheic flows, between those groundwater flows and the river itself. The important thing here that I'm trying to get across with this figure is that water flowing through a variety of very heterogeneous flow paths and habitat types. We want that because that promotes a diversity of organisms. There are many more habitats to choose from, and so there can be a lot of organisms associated with each one of these different habitat types. So maintenance of flow within a range of variation, so it goes from flooding to base flow, is fundamental, and it follows all of these different flow paths that are shown in this figure.
We'll come back to that in a moment in terms of the normal range of variation.
Right.
But before getting there, would you give us an overview of what kind of organisms live in this interconnected water system?
Right. Well, you can probably everyone can put their own organisms in this picture. My personal ones that I work with so much and actually rather well known for is that I discovered that in the white area there that are fed by the river, the red arrows, live a large-bodied stonefly group that nobody knew about. And so we discovered that, and they moved from the groundwater to the surface water to reproduce. They grow in the groundwater and then come back to the river to reproduce. And that was a life history strategy that had never been known before. Yeah.
The area, Dr. Stanford, that you're referring to?
Yes, that's the so-called hyporheic or alluvial aquifer portion of the river system. And all rivers have these. In fact, the farmers know this because if they wanted to have an irrigation right, they could just dig a hole in the with a backhoe or something in the area along the river there where those plants are growing and extract water from the groundwater. It's really river water, but it's gone underground and then pumped out into the fields. Well, this process of water moving down the channel and exchanging with these deeper deposits is really important in determining what kind of water we have, because as water penetrates from the channel and goes into those gravel beds, It cleans it. It's like those wetlands along the river that are three-dimensional are functioning like our kidneys, pulling out the pollution and cleaning the water. And so very often we'll be going down a river that's flowing with a lot of mud in it, but there'll be a side flow that's clear. That's one that's coming out of the aquifer directly to the river, and it's really clean water.
Dr. Stanford, you mentioned this term, the natural range of variation in the flow paths of Montana's river systems. How does climate change affect this natural range?
Yeah, the picture here has a spring spate for a snowmelt river like mostly we have in Montana to a base flow. And the range of variation is the long-term average of peak flows versus the long-term average of base flows. That's the range of variation. And all of the organisms that live in these systems, and that's thousands and thousands of species, are all framing their life around that predictability of spring, spate, fall, low water, and the temperatures that go along with that. So as climate warms the river basins to the point that we're beyond that range of variation, the organisms don't have the predictability that they need to be able to complete their life cycle. They might come out of their hibernation too soon, or they might emerge looking for a mate and not as an insect emerging from the river and not find one because the temperatures are too warm. So this range of variation that is supporting the organisms is fundamental to their lifestyle and life history story.
And so is it your opinion that this natural range of variation has been disrupted in Montana's freshwater ecosystem by climate change?
Yes.
And in your opinion, as a freshwater ecologist, what can and what should be done?
Well, the most obvious thing to do is reduce the amount of greenhouse gases so that you can have a pull the climate back into that range of variation that the organisms are looking for and that we as users of the river basins are looking for.
And in terms of your understanding, I see in your expert report you referred to the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment, chief author of which was Dr. Whitlick, which concluded that the annual air temperatures in Montana have increased several degrees. And could you explain the effect of the increase in average annual
soil systems and the rest of the components of a watershed are used to seeing by increasing the temperature so that drying and droughts are more extended? As you dry out soils, they become less, the soils become less absorptive of water, and the plants, therefore, are going to be influenced negatively in that way.
Does this have a negative feedback loop in terms of that hydrologic cycle that you were discussing before in terms of the loss of waters from our plants and
yes.
the whole interconnectivity of the cycle?
Yes. The component that's important here is the transpiration component from the plants. Now, that transpiration is the outcome of metabolism by the plants to grow. And so, having less and less water available to them begins to stress them to the point that stress occurs over several years as this climate warms, and eventually they've either got to, though there's not much a plant can do, it can't move, but they have many of the animals, they can move, and they will move if that watershed is interconnected, like I've described multiple times now.
How do aquatic systems help with carbon storage?
Well, the productivity and the productivity by green plants in the water is a fundamental source of sink for carbon because the photosynthetic process requires carbon dioxide. So our aquatic systems do, particularly the wetlands, are really important in sequestering carbon. Now, that sequestering of carbon often enriches the plant communities so that they grow more. And a lot of climate concerns are talking about what's called carbon fertilization. The plants are really sequestering carbon, and that's causing more growth. As you get more growth, more carbon is stored. But it's not that simple. Be careful with that concept, because as plants cover the landscape, they change the albedo, the reflection of the sun's energy off the surface, and that can provide even an offset of warming that we would think you would get if you were just calculating the amount of CO2 sequestered by the normal photosynthetic process of the prairies.
Dr. Stanford, you mentioned a moment ago that one of the impacts from climate-related changes to the hydrologic cycle here in this interconnected ecosystem was changes in the spring spate. Can you describe what changes are occurring with that portion of Montana's freshwater ecosystem and what consequences that's having across the landscape?
There's a high degree of certainty that mountain rivers in the West, including Montana's, are losing water to the flow path earlier in the year. In other words, the snow melts and spate that comes with that is happening earlier and earlier. The Flathead River used to flood routinely the first week of June. It's now peaking very much earlier than that. So the timing and the duration of the runoff is really fundamental to the organisms. And if that timing is changed enough, those organisms are either going to die or they're going to have to move. And if they have a reservoir in the way or a dam or some other obstruction that interrupts the connectivity that I keep talking about, then they can't move, but they will move if they can. If they're mobile organisms, fish, flying insects, I don't know about farmers. I started to say farmers, but it's hard to leave your landscape if you're a farmer. I come from that kind of background, and what you depend on as a source of water begins to dry up. That's extreme.
Dr. Stanford, have you built any simulations to model these projected impacts that are occurring and expected to occur going forward?
Yeah, back in the time around 2010 or so, we became really concerned. The big concern about climate warming really began to influence our thinking within the scientific community. And I wanted to know what we could project for runoff in our river systems in Montana and indeed around the Pacific Rim, at least in North America. And so we got together a group of scientists, some climate scientists and some river ecologists, And we built a model that described the hydrologic cycle and all the parameters that influence it for a mountain landscape. And then we used a period of record of discharge measurements in a variety of these rivers to calibrate the model. So the model was built to show how the water resources in a catchment were being used and what the flow would be. And we calibrated it with a portion of the record that occurred for each of these river systems that we studied. And it was all the major rivers in Montana and quite a few of them in northern BC and Alaska and on around. And the outcome was a model that recognized or predicted the flows. We kept some of the discharge records aside and didn't use them to calibrate the model so that we could check and see how good the model would produce the flows. So the model told us that the flows were thus and so and were correct about 70% of the time. And a lot of people said, well, that's not such a great model. It's only right 70% of the time. It's only right 70% of the time. It's wrong 30% of the time. Well, I'd rather be 70% right than 30% wrong. So it's the glass half full situation. And the results are shown here. The graph on the left.
Let's start. Okay, I was just going to start because it's there on the left. Could you describe for us what we're seeing here in terms of, I see, if I'm understanding correctly, the x-axis starts with the calendar year, the months throughout the year. Is that correct?
Yes.
And as we go through in terms of your model, I see there's a differentiation of about a month up here in terms of these peaks. What's going on there?
So the green curve is the 60s, or so I'll say pre-significant climate warming estimates. And then the red and purple curves are more recent and our projections out to 2040 or 2080. So what you see in the difference between those peaks, green versus the colored ones, is that change in the timing of runoff. It's moved forward from what it historically was. And then on the other side, there you see the mean monthly temperatures. And just as you'd expect, if the runoff has changed, moved forward, the water that's coming down the river channel is going to be a lot warmer today and in the future than it was in the 60s. So what you're looking at here is a predicted change of up almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit in the water temperature of the river, and the flows are going to be shifted forward. And the flows actually in this particular stream flow diagram don't decrease that much, but they are decreasing.
And so the green to the purple. These peak stream flows it appears to be moving then from the first week or so of June and back into May, if I draw a line, an intersecting line there, is that what was predicted by the model?
Yeah.
Your model, and by the way, it's fully described in the expert report, but it would be Wu and Stanford et al., 2012, is that the...
I would be the last author. There are several other authors, but the first author is W.U. Wu.
Okay. And your model is dated 2012. Have more recent studies corroborated your basic conclusions?
Yeah, thankfully. The more recent modeling efforts are much more sophisticated than what we built. And yet their predictions are pretty much the same as what we got. I cite in my report two studies that sort of give us the credibility we're hoping for.
And that would include the Jones, Mulfeld, Marshall study of 2017.
Yes, and then the Isaacs
study. Yeah. Yes. Dr. Stanford, In your opinion, is it human-caused climate change that is responsible for these significant shifts that your model predicted and that, in fact, we're experiencing today?
Yes.
I'd like to direct your attention next to a demonstrative exhibit, which is an image of the Yellowstone River flooding parts of the Paradise Valley last year, earlier this week it would have been the anniversary of that unfortunate event. But is this a recent example of the intense spring flooding of which you spoke?
Yeah, as the runoff or the discharge in our rivers has changed and moved forward, it also seems to be accompanied by a more unpredictable and chaotic event, by more unpredictable and chaotic events that we wouldn't have normally predicted. These are rain on snow events that are occurring more frequently today than they did in the past. And that's the consequence of it shown in the picture there, that the river is flooded much higher than ever has been recorded. But by the same token, that runoff occurs so quick, so fast, the river system can be pretty dry by late August because all the water went out in one slug.
That event was referred to as a 500-year event. What, if any, significance does that have to you?
Well, I'm not sure, because it seems like we're getting 100-year floods every 20 years or so these days. So it's hard to say.
What about the effects of these phenomena that we've been discussing on aquifers? What happens to the landscape when aquifers are depleted?
Well, remember, the aquifers are doing two important things. One, they're cleaning the water. They're like kidneys. They're cleaning the water. And number two, they're a storage of water that then leaks back into the river system as flow and above ground environment is curtailed as the season goes by. There are many examples of rivers in Montana and elsewhere where the surface flow actually disappears. But it doesn't mean the river is gone. It's just now flowing through the alluvial aquifers down below. But if we get to the point where the alluvial aquifers are not recharging or completely depleted, we're approaching a dead zone in the river.
Dr. Stanford, you mentioned a while ago that we're experiencing, from human-caused climate change, disruptions beyond the normal range of variation in Montana's freshwater ecosystem. With reference to this diagram from your expert report in the EPA study, could you kind of describe for us, as we move through the freshwater ecosystem, the consequences of those disruptions beyond normal range of variation?
Our river systems have a high degree of biodiversity. We have a lot of organisms that live in our river systems, and all of the habitats you see sort of displayed in this picture. And as you push the system beyond the range of variation in flow and temperature that's occurred over, let's say, the past 500 years that these organisms have evolved, they lose the predictability of the environment that they need, that they must have in order to complete their life cycle. So it's going to depress the biodiversity, because the organisms are faced with the choice of dying or moving, and most of them will try to move. Now, if we're talking about a species that lives way up high in the mountain range and it doesn't have any higher to go, then its maintenance is threatened. Organisms that are further down in the watershed may have large volumes of water to help them get through the warm periods, but we're seeing more and more periods when the water is really warm in our river systems, and that's reflected in what are called the hoot owl laws that Fish and Game is using now for fishing. Because the water is simply too warm, and they have no choice but to shut it down in order to protect the very fisheries that are promoting the fly fishing and other sports that are going on. And yeah.
Dr. Stanford, we've been focusing at least a substantial amount of your attention on Montana's riverine system. If I could change a little bit the focus of our conversation to discuss climate change impacts on Montana's lakes, could you give us an overview of those impacts?
Well, let's distinguish, first of all, between a lake and a river, lake and a reservoir. Many of our big so-called lakes are actually reservoirs that are storing water that would otherwise be going on downstream, and they're fundamental parts of fundamental parts of the river hydrology. The lakes, on the other hand, around the world, recent papers shows that lakes are, in general, declining in the amount of water in them. The volume of the lakes is decreasing. And we haven't done that kind of work in Montana yet to really look closely at water flux and how storage influences water flux, except on Flathead Lake. There we have a long-term record of flux of water and materials into the lake and the consequence of those materials being transported into the lake. But Flathead Lake has a very big reservoir upstream and a dam in the outlet, and so its hydrology is very much influenced by the way those dams are operated. Nonetheless, the surface temperatures of Flathead Lake are gradually increasing, and we have continuously monitored the conditions in Flathead Lake since 1977. So this is a very well understood lake and a great place to talk about what the consequences are. When the surface temperatures get too high or get up to the point where metabolism by the organisms is stressed, that's a negative. And fortunately, Flathead Lake has a very deep water column, and the bottom of the lake, the deep parts of the lake, are staying cold. That's a normal process in a big lake like Flathead. So for the bull trout, which is a cold-loving species that lives deep in the water column, it's not going to be influenced as much as a cutthroat, for example, which both of those are native fish that are found feeding in the surface layers. So temperature is really influencing when these things do what they need to do to reproduce. Both of them migrate far upstream to spawn in the river systems. So the cue for them to get going upstream is really important to their life history maintenance. Now, Flathead Lake has this bizarre history of what's called a food web cascade. We had a lake that was known for its cutthroat and bull trout fisheries that suddenly were replaced by the introduction of kokanee salmon into the lake. And for a lot of people, they forgot about the times the cutthroats were there and began to focus on catching kokanee, which was a very sought after good fish. A kokanee is a landlocked red salmon. So that was in a way, kind of an interesting story that suddenly we had millions of kokanee in the lake. But then a mice and shrimp was introduced along with lake trout into the lake. And that shrimp was able to outcompete the kokanee for the available crustacean food webs in the water, the crustacean species in the water column that were the primary food items for the kokanee. So the shrimps, unfortunately, do their feeding at the lake surface at night and then go to the bottom of the lake in the daytime. So they're unavailable to the kokanee. And perhaps you know the story, all of you, that the mice and shrimp was the natural food of lake trout. And both of them being non-native species, lake trout and mice are native as a food web components in the Great Lakes. So we suddenly turned the fishery over the last 30 years into a Great Lakes type of food web, as opposed to the original cutthroat bull trout dominated food web.
Dr. Stanford, the summary that I put up on the slide also indicates that accelerated loading of nitrogen in the water and air are a consequence of climate change impacts. Could you explain that?
Yeah. For years, we were watching the rates at which nitrogen and phosphorus were being delivered to the lake, because that determined the amount of primary production or algal production in the lake and how at the base of the food web. And so, over the years, we've gradually seen, loading of nitrogen increase to the point that now we have a severe nutrient imbalance in the lake, a great deal of nitrogen and too little phosphorus to maintain a healthy phytoplankton or photosynthetic component in the food web. And the only source that we can find that is causing this is an increase in the loading of nitrogen from the atmosphere and from the watershed as a consequence of changed hydrology and changed forest types that have been very dramatically influenced by forest fires. So drier conditions, more forest fires, more loading of the atmosphere with dust and smoke and other particles are providing this excess nitrogen that is now of concern to the well-being of the existing food web in the lake, and we may suddenly be on the doorstep of yet another trophic cascade.
Dr. Stanford, are invasive species another impact to the freshwater ecosystems of Montana's lakes that can result from climate change?
Well, the point is that invasives are have a negative impact on the food webs of the lakes that they get into or the systems that they get into. And if those organisms are more adapted to warmer water and we're seeing the water's warm, then they're going to be more successful than they otherwise would. And this has been demonstrated very clearly for rainbow trout in the flathead system, because they are more warm adapted than are our native cutthroats. And so the range of the rainbow has expanded to the point where they're pushing the cutthroats out and actually also interbreeding with them. And we call it, they're interbreeding with the cutthroats and changing that gene pool to the point that it's rainbow dominated. And that research is really novel and very well documented by the USGS folks in Glacier Park.
Okay. In your opinion, then, Dr. Stanford, has fishing for bull trout and native cutthroat trout already been impacted by climate change?
Oh, very definitely.
In terms of other examples of climate warming impacts on Montana's aquatic biota, biota. I've noticed that some of your research in the past, and are you aware or could explain to us how the reduced snow and glacial meltwaters have imperiled cold adapted aquatic insects in and around Glacier National Park?
Right. There are several papers about a particular group of stoneflies, Plecoptera, sometimes called salmon flies, that are very unique inhabitants of the high streams in Glacier Park and other places in the Rocky Mountains that only live in extremely cold glacial meltwaters. And as those glaciers disappear, those meltwaters get warmer. These flies have no place to go. So some of them are candidates for listing under ESA Endangered Species Act.
I'd like to turn next to circle back here to the climate impacts to rivers that are important to the plaintiffs. I've shared with you rivers that either our plaintiffs have testified to or I'm representing to you to assume that we will have testimony from our plaintiffs and ask you as an expert and familiar with these river systems, to kind of take us on a little tour around these several river systems to discuss the climate-related impacts to these rivers that are important to the plaintiffs as fisheries. Tell us about the climate impacts, if you would, beginning with the Clark Fork River.
Okay. So these are data from the Montana Climate Assessment, and it shows that the Clark Fork River is experiencing reduced stream flow in recent years, and that that means that the discharge is decreasing. So those are direct impacts of a warmer climate and are affecting the Clark Fork. The Clark Fork is an important river in the scheme of things in Montana because it's a low-altitude river. It has some mountain headwaters, but much of it is in lower elevations, and that makes it more vulnerable to climate warming and lack of snowpack.
Would we direct your attention next to the Flathead River? And could you tell us about the climate-related impacts to the Flathead River?
Yeah, same story. Lowering stream flows, at least in the unregulated parts of the basin. And the impacts I just summarized about the cutthroat and interacting with the rainbow trout. And bull trout, if they spawn in the wrong place at the wrong time, their eggs and nests that they have left their progeny in are destroyed.
I'd like to direct your attention next to the Missouri River and ask you to summarize the climate-related impacts to the Missouri.
The Missouri is one of our big rivers, and its discharge is also declining, according to the climate assessment. And stream temperatures are increasing, and I mentioned fishing restrictions before. As a consequence of the water's just too warm for the fishermen to catch and release healthy fish, so the managers have to close portions of the Missouri system and other rivers to fishing, at least catch and release fishing. And fishing restrictions are broad-based because the effects of high temperatures on sport fish is really well known. So when they reach a particular level, which is right around 20 degrees centigrade, and I forget whether it is Fahrenheit, they have to shut it down. Now, this last topic that shows up in the Missouri is really important. The algal blooms that occur in the Missouri are driven, again, by nutrient loading, just like in Flathead. But the nutrient loads are high naturally in the Missouri system because it's draining Yellowstone, and that geothermal activity really puts a lot of nutrients into the water. And so as the lake surfaces and the river surfaces get warmer and warmer, these blue-green algae tend to take off or bloom in portions of Missouri, particularly Canyon Ferry, the reservoirs by Canyon Ferry, and on downstream. And these are blue-green algae that, when they're really abundant, can produce toxins. There are stories of cattle dying in their tracks when they're drinking water that's loaded with these big algal blooms. And we're seeing some of that in the Flathead system in the lower reaches down on the reservation in Crow Reservoir, extreme blooms of blue-green algae during warm water. You have to have high temperatures to get these things to grow and take off. And those high temperatures are occurring more and more often. So the blooms are going to occur more and more often.
Next, Dr. Stanford, impacts on the Yellowstone River.
Same story, change in timing, change in flow. Anytime fish are stressed and there's some diseases around, they're going to be having a rough time. The floods that occurred on the Yellowstone were focused on the Yellowstone, which you don't normally see that much focus of intense flooding. It's chaotic. It's not predictable in the record. So things are changing. Brown trout populations, they say, have declined. And again, we have this algal bloom situation. We can't stress this algal problem more because as water warms up, we've got these microbes that are highly adapted to warm conditions, high nutrient loads, and they're nasty critters. They produce a very bad toxin.
Next, Dr. Stanford, if I could direct your attention to the same question as to the Powder River, which testimony is established flows through the ranch that Ricky's family owns. Have you been to the Powder River?
Yeah, I did some work down there quite a few years ago. Know the situation pretty well. The Powder is major tributaries, I think, is the Tongue River. And the conditions there are, again, stream flow declining. And the river, the Powder River, has actually gone dry at least once, dry at the surface at least. And this decline in water quality that's that shows up in the report is associated with salt that's discharged by the intense drilling for petroleum that occurs in the Powder River drainage. The drillers use salt water to facilitate the completion of the wells. And a lot of that escapes and gets into the river system. And so you have a problem of low stream flow, higher temperatures, coupled with a major pollutant. And that can occur anywhere. We see that in the Flathead. It may not be salt that's the pollutant. It might be PCBs, or it might be outfalls from sewage with high nutrient loads. But the point is that pollution problems are exacerbated by higher temperatures and lower flows.
You mentioned that there's these water quality impacts from discharges associated with fossil fuel drilling. What about other related to other fossil fuel activities such as strip mining?
Well, mining is in a class of its own, of course, because a lot of times we have pollution from runoff or from water that's generated in the mine sites. And those have been studied in a variety of places in Montana and a variety of the rivers, but it's the same story. Those pollutants interact with lower flows and higher temperatures.
And does this affect the water quality related to agricultural activities?
Yes. If you have a farming system that's dependent on water from one of these rivers that's showing deteriorating water quality, that can have impact on the productivity of plants, particularly in the case of salt.
Could I direct your attention next, Dr. Stanford, to the Madison River?
Madison, one of our iconic river systems. Temperatures are warming at a rate of about 1.7 degrees centigrade. That's about 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. Madison River, one of our iconic trout streams, is getting warmer fast. And that results in declining discharge, fishing closures, same story, algal blooms. Fish die also occurred, particularly below Ennis Dam, and river closures. The managers have no other choice. And when you close a river that's popular for fishing, the fishermen are going to move to a more cold-adapted system, but that puts a lot of pressure on those systems. So the way in which the fishing is spread out across the state changes, and that has economic ramifications because there are less fishermen in certain areas and more fishermen in other areas.
Directing your attention next to the Blackfoot River, could you summarize the impacts to that river?
Again, the climate assessment came up with these three issues for the Blackfoot, and these are sort of repetitious to what we've seen before in other Montana rivers.
Smith River,
same thing, I think. Even record low flows. Smith River is a famous rafting river, and I think the rafting is curtailed because of the association of rafting with fishing. So increasing temperatures and fishing restriction are in play there.
And then next, the Shields River.
low flows and river closures are listed in the climate assessment. I don't know much about the Shields River.
Okay. What about the Bitterroot River?
Bitterroot River is close to home. A lot of work has been done on the Bitterroot. It's a great alluvial aquifer river system, big expansive alluvial systems along the shoreline, along the river, very, very important riparian forests. And yet we're still seeing the same problems there, including apparently fish with unexplained lesions. Lesions often occur in fish when they've been exposed to some sort of toxic pollution.
Dr. Stanford, taking just a step back then, having kind of done a walk about Montana and Montana's famous rivers, some of those rivers flow into Montana. Some flow out. In your expert opinion, does it make sense to prohibit consideration of impacts of climate change when assessing impacts to the aquatic ecosystems you've studied?
Nonsense.
So, Dr. Stanford, to be clear, in your expert opinion, are the rivers, lakes, and freshwater resources and fisheries of Montana that these youth plaintiffs depend on for their health, safety, well-being already experiencing significant degradation as a result of warming temperatures caused by anthropogenic climate change?
I think that's the case, and I think the science and the measurements that have been made make that a virtual certainty.
Okay. Then in terms of kind of summarizing up the course of your testimony here this afternoon, Dr. Stanford, and in your earlier disclosure, could you review with us, using this slide as useful to summarize for the court the impacts that and effects that you have observed in terms of climate change on Montana's freshwater ecosystems?
Our ecosystem, our freshwater systems are under the same umbrella, the same threat as most of the world due to climate change occurring as we live. And anthropogenic change is unambiguous in Montana as well. Variation in the, go ahead.
I was going to ask you guys for the next summarize, and what about variation in the river networks?
We need to remember that what we're trying to maintain in our river system is the heterogeneity of the habitat landscape. In the big diagram, I showed so many different habitat types that are influenced by the range of variation in our river systems. And when we lose that, we're losing a good share of the resilience and resistance of our river systems to climate change. So we've got to get the range of variation back down into about what's existed for the last 500 years or so. And I have to go back to the Ice Age or anything like that. It's just that since about 500 years ago, things kind of locked in terms of the biodiversity that we have in particular river systems, the river network, how it exists. And we've got to use that information to help us design plans to curtail CO2 and other greenhouse gases.
And Dr. Stanford, in your opinion, does this third bullet, which states rivers and fisheries that these youth plaintiffs depend on for their health, safety, and well-being are already experiencing significant degradation as a result of warming temperatures caused by anthropogenic climate change?
It's already happening. It's a fact. It's something that we have to deal with, not only for our plaintiffs, but for all of us. We're as dependent on our water resources as any other group of people. And Montana should be a leader, because many of our waterways are far less influenced by human activities than many of the other rivers around the world. So Montana could be a place where we really show and lead in terms of recovering from greenhouse gas pollution.
Thank you, Dr. Stanford. I have no further questions.
You want to take a break now or in about 15 minutes?
15 minutes will be good. We can go for a while. I'm fine.
Okay. All right, let's start.
Go ahead. Regarding the Smith River flows and the statement that flows were so low in June of this year that the river was closed to boating, are you certain that that's occurred this year?
No, what I quoted were from the climate assessment, so I can't verify or deny what actually happened.
Okay, and would that be the case for all of the things you've been talking about?
No, just the situation that you raised, which is when was the river closed to boating?
Just for the Smith River.
Just for the Smith River.
And all the other rivers you talked about, the information is as of today?
As far as I know, the climate assessment is accurate.
Okay. I want to start by asking you about nutrient loading. What sources cause the excess nutrients to be found in, let's just take Flathead Lake as an example?
That's something we worked on for years. What are the sources of nutrients that are coming into the lake and how does the lake respond to that nutrient loading? And of course, the river system itself has a certain amount of loading that occurs and that increases during the spring spate. That's when a good share of the nutrients come in, and it comes in association with the fine sediments that are delivered to the lake. Now, not all of that is biologically available, and it gets very complex very quickly. But over the years, and as I said, we've monitored that. The biostation has monitored the loading rates of nitrogen and phosphorus and other nutrients to the lake since 1977 continuously. And one of the things that surprised us was the amount of nutrients that actually comes out of the atmosphere as opposed to being transported in by the rivers. Some years, as much as 30% of the load of NNP, nitrogen, phosphorus, comes right out of the atmosphere. And we measured that by collectors that we placed in various positions around the lake and collected the dry and wet fall that occurred. So the atmospheric delivery is an important source. The sources in the watershed that are abnormal would be associated with sewage treatment, sewage and hard surface runoff in the Flathead Valley, and some more limited export of nutrients associated with road building and forestry activities.
And what about agriculture?
Very little agriculture in the Flathead that can be charged with losing nutrients to the river system. We did not see enough ag there in that valley to do to say or to argue for some sort of best management practices which could curtail it even further. That said, however, there are best management practices that much of the ag community embraces that limit nutrient loading.
What about nutrient loading in the Powder River as agriculture being a source?
There are probably points where it's a problem, but I don't know that it's a widespread problem in the Powder. I look mostly at the salt issue.
I'm sorry, at what?
I look mostly at the salt issue.
Okay. And with your position at the Flathead Biological Station, I'm sure you must have been familiar with the state's efforts to control nutrient loading in Flathead Lake, correct?
Not just the state, but all of the citizens of the Flathead Valley really stepped up to minimize the nutrients coming into the lake. And it's ironic that we did such a good job of it that we now have this imbalance of nitrogen and phosphorus in the lake. But it's the way it came down. But we still have one of the cleanest lakes in the world in Flathead Lake, and it is truly a jewel in the crown of Ghana. And it's a consequence of the science interacting in a positive way over long term with the residents of the valley.
Are you familiar at all with current efforts by the state of Montana to regulate nutrients on a statewide basis through water quality regulations?
I'm not familiar with the state's actions beyond the 390, whatever it was under the Clean Water Act that mandated the state determine the condition in terms of nutrients for every stream in the state. And I think they, I don't know, I assume they did that. And if they did, that would be contributing to the reduction of nutrients in the watersheds, as have nearly every other state in the country done.
And I think the other thing is 310, section 310.
That sounds right, yes.
Let me back up now a little bit, if I could, Dr. Stanford. What materials did you review, let's say, recently in preparation for your testimony today?
I reviewed papers that mostly studies that I was familiar with and that supported the contentions that I had at a particular point in my report. I did not do a large-scale literature search on a particular subject, like, say, nutrient loading. I just used, to make my points, the papers that I was most familiar with. And, of course, a lot of that is focused on Flathead Lake, where we worked so hard on that issue. And the people who I resigned as director of the Flathead Lake Biological Station in 2016, and the people who came in behind me have kept that record going. Outstanding researchers that are finding out more about how nutrients play out in the phytoplankton community of the lake.
Did you discuss your testimony with plaintiff's counsel before, in recent times, before getting on the witness stand today? Meet with lawyers here?
Sure.
What did you talk about?
And I'm going to object on attorney work product.
Your Honor, he's a disclosed expert. There's no legitimate privilege that applies at this point.
You can answer.
What we did is discuss my points so that they would understand what it, they asked me to write a report on climate change impacts in Montana. That's what I did. My report has some areas in it that are pretty complex scientifically, and they asked me questions about that, and I elaborated, but it didn't go beyond that.
That's fine. I just needed to ask.
Yeah.
Did you review the – I know at one point, and I took your deposition, so I remember we talked about you reviewing the complaint that was filed in this case.
Say that again,
the complaint
please.
That the plaintiffs filed in this case, did you review that recently at all?
I did.
Okay. Did you have any discussion with plaintiff's attorneys about the how some of the claims in that complaint no longer apply here?
I don't recall that discussion, no.
Is there anything in the testimony that you've given today that identifies impacts to Montana directly attributable solely to emissions in Montana, but greenhouse gas emissions, excuse me.
Solely?
Yes, sir.
Well, I can't think of a study off the top of my head where greenhouse gases were quantified in a very localized area, let's say around a particular river system, and it was shown that those gases were responsible for the climate warming for that river. But I have seen work around some of the coal-fired power plants and other sources, other sites that have a difficulty in controlling both the gases and other pollutants coming from them. I have seen those kinds of studies, and they go on way back in history. So
sure,
there's lots of them.
And for those types of studies, the emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions, for example, go into the atmosphere and mix with similar sources and other sources of greenhouse gases globally, correct?
Yeah, we're a contributor just like everybody else.
And the discussion that you provided about hydrological cycle and all of that, that applies everywhere in the world.
Yes.
Correct?
No, strike that. I'd like to ask you about the Yellowstone River flooding from 2021. And as you stated, there's...
Council, just a typographical error. Was it 2022?
2022, you're right. I'm sorry. I thought you said 21. Last year. We've talked already in the courtroom, you may not know about whether that was a 500-year flood event, and some people have described it as such. How would you describe it using that kind of nomenclature, if you would at all?
Well, if that nomenclature was used by a credible source like the USGS, and they actually measured it and concluded from their measurements that the flow was would not have occurred but once in the last 500 years, I'd have to agree with them. But on the other hand, to me, that event is sort of inexplicable, and because of its focused area and sort of chaotic occurrence. So I think there's more to the story than just categorizing it as a 500-year flood.
Did I hear you correctly to say that that water level in that event was higher than has ever been recorded?
I saw that written about it, but I don't know if I said that or not.
Okay. And where did you see that written? Was that
I saw it in news articles.
With regard to the Flathead River system, well, let's just put that in northwestern Montana. There are several dams that impact how those rivers are managed. Is that true?
You bet.
You've got Hungry Horse Dam, right? And that's a Bureau of Reclamation facility?
Or, you know, yes, I think that's correct.
And then in northwest Montana for the Kootenai River, you have Libby Dam. That's a Corps of Engineers facility, correct?
Yes, I think so.
And these facilities are managed by the federal government, right?
Well, you're getting beyond my expertise a bit in the sense that how the dams are operated and what's driving decisions on operations, whether it's whether it's water supply downstream, flood control, or electricity, it gets complicated fast. And so to say that for Libby, the Corps of Engineers is overseeing that would be right, but whether their decisions are theirs alone is probably not true.
And for Hungry Horse and Libby Dam, the management decisions, as you've just said, involve many factors, and these include also requirements mandated by the Endangered Species Act, correct?
Well, any activity that impinges on a listed species will probably be taken up by someone, and I've been involved with quite a few of those kinds of interventions to protect those endangered fishes, in most cases it was fishes, from whatever activity had been suggested as a problem for them to determine whether or not it was a problem. I've done a lot of that. But I'm not sure how that relates to your question.
Well, if you're getting there, and let's take the Flathead River, for example. Decisions made about the level of flow in the Flathead River coming out of Hungry Horse involve a myriad of factors, do they not?
Yes, but it's interesting that very often one particular issue will float to the surface on how the dams operated. In the case of Hungry Horse, let me give you an example. For years, as the dam was built, they discharged from the bottom of the reservoir, or definitely below the thermocline. So the water that came down the river certain times was really cold and was really influencing the growth of fish. And so I participated in some of the studies dealing with demonstrating that and suggesting that let's rebuild the outlet structures so they discharge from near the surface to better reflect the range of variation that would be normally occurring in the river downstream of that dam. And frankly, the same thing in a different way was done on Kerr Dam. So all of that influenced the flux of water through Flathead Lake, but overall the impact of the dam was reduced, at least in the river system between the dam and the lake.
And by and the factor that those decisions were targeting was temperature of the water, is that right?
Temperature.
Does the temperature affect the growth of nutrients?
No, I'm going to say that the nutrient problem is separate from the temperature problem when it comes to individual impacts, like impacts on cutthroat trout, for example. The temperature effect is has a direct impact, but as water temperatures are influenced by discharge from the dams or discharge in general, there is an interaction there. So you have to sort that out. How much has the temperature problem been ameliorated by the dam discharges, and how does that relate to what's actually happening on the unregulated portions of the basin, Middle Fork and North Fork?
And the, and these rivers that have major, or well, any dam that regulates the flows, have the potential and the reality of impacting the bug population on those streams, right?
Oh yeah. We had, part of my early work was showing that the bug community below Hungry Horse Dam, directly down to the confluence of the main river, was very different and depauperate from what was occurring in the main river. I mean, dramatically different.
You said that you thought, and I gather you weren't sure, that the Powder River, that the Tongue River was a tributary of the Powder River. Are you sure about that?
No. I thought so this morning, and I tried to check, but I didn't get it done.
Okay. Yeah.
But both of them are influenced by some salt, I think. And is it a tributary or not?
I don't know.
It's not.
It goes into the Yellowstone.
Okay.
West of there.
Okay.
Is there a ambient or natural level of salt in some of these eastern Montana streams that's responsible in part, at least, for the loading?
You know, I did a lot of work on salt pollution in the Colorado River system, and some of those high salt tributaries were ones that were draining salt domes, natural salt domes, natural deposits. And I do not know whether those kinds of deposits are in the either the Tongue or the Powder River, but I don't think they are. And I would leave that as an open question.
Okay. Are you from your experience, extensive experience in Montana, familiar with the Montana Environmental Policy Act, how it functions?
Only to the extent of what I was given by counsel to read. And that was a summary, I think. For some reason, that particular, it's called the, what is it called again?
Well, MEPA is the shorthand. We talk about MEPA.
Say the long term.
Montana Environmental Policy Act.
Oh, I think I do. I think I have. Well, let's just say I'm not an expert on that, and it's none of that is in my report.
Okay. We have no further questions, Your Honor. Thank you, Dr. Stinson.
You're welcome.
Can you read your
just one follow-up question, right, Your Honor, if I might?
Yes.
Dr. Stanford, to clarify, in your opinion, do Montana's greenhouse gas emissions contribute to the degradation of Montana's freshwater ecosystems?
Yes.
No further questions, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. You may sit down.
Thank you.